With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Coming up, Ben Elwood and I start our Sofia Coppola movie watch with her first film, The Virgin Suicides. I'll also have a chat with you about episode 4 of WandaVision, and I'll give you a graphic novel recommendation with volume 1 of Something Is Killing the Children. Regardless of the subject matter, I promise you, this is a fun podcast. My name is Justin Hamilton, and you're listening to Big Squid. Honestly, wasn't until I was putting together that little intro that I thought, wow, on paper, this podcast sounds grim, doesn't it? Like, you know, Something Is Killing the Children, The Virgin Suicides, even WandaVision has got some pretty heavy stuff going on. But I promise you, it's a fun podcast and the discussion is a lot of fun. And if you're a fan of the quirks and mannerisms that seem to crop up when Ben and I are hanging out, I know of them because you've written about it on our private Facebook page. If you had a little drink every time one of them came along, I'm not saying you'll be drunk, but you might be a little bit tipsy. So keep an ear out for that. Just also letting you know that I'm planning on starting the Leftovers rewatch this week too. So keep an eye out for bonus episodes. Maybe Thursday, possibly Friday. I'll try to get it out before the weekend. I was going to start it last week, but ended up scoring a job down in Melbourne. And I had to get a visa. How weird is that? Had to get a visa to fly down to Melbourne and then had to go straight into quarantine and get COVID tested. And everything's good, in case you were wondering. And then I worked on an advert that will run during the Australian Open behind the scenes. I was doing some writing and some workshopping with a, I don't know what I'm allowed to say, maybe a prominent talent. If you've been over once again at our private page, you already know what I'm talking about. Keep an eye out for them. I think they're pretty funny. And yeah, maybe once they're up and about, I can talk to you a little bit more. And by the way, if you want to join the Big Squid Facebook page, there's an open one, but if you want to join the private one, anyone can join. I don't care if you're wearing thongs and a tank top. For anyone overseas, flip-flops. I know that you might be thinking, oh, that's a bit sexy, but either way, come and join us. But anyway, the shoot was fun, but it was exhausting, and just when I was about to catch up on sleep, I went to the Opera House on Saturday to see Judith Lucy and Denise Scott in their new show, one of the all-time great double acts. Are they a double act? No, they're solo acts, but they're also brilliant together. They're brilliant by themselves, they're brilliant together, and I was really lucky to not only see their show, but get to hang out with them afterwards. But suffice to say, I'm still recovering from last week. And so, turns out, as you get older, you don't bounce back like you used to. What a shock. But anyway, we will get that Leftovers episode up soon. The first item I want to talk to you about is Volume 1 of Something is Killing the Children. I'd seen the title while perusing stuff at the comic shop when it first came out as monthly issues, and at the time I was reading too much, and to be honest, sometimes things start and you, I don't know, they kind of disappear, or they go from being monthly to bi-monthly to you're sitting around going, when's issue 4 coming out? And then it never comes out, or by the time it does come out, you've kind of lost momentum with it. And I thought, you know what, it's an interesting title, and I'll keep an eye on it, and when it comes out as a graphic novel, I'll pick it up then. And then, of course, 2020 happened, and I forgot all about it, and then by chance, I saw a review of the first volume and decided next time I was in at my local comic shop, I was going to pick it up. Something is Killing the Children was a Will Eisner nominee for Best New Series in 2020, and I can see why. It's created by James Tynion IV, Werther Deledera, and Miquel Moreto. I hope I've gotten their names correct. And it starts the story off in a place called Archer's Peak, a very normal-looking small town in the States. Recently, though, children have gone missing, and while most never return, the ones that do come back have terrible stories, almost impossible stories about a terrifying creature that exists only in the shadows. Of course, nobody believes these stories until the arrival of a mysterious woman called Erica Slaughter. This is exactly what the town needs, and you know why? Because Erica kills monsters, and she's very, very good at it. Deledera and Moreto's artwork is amazing as it segues between being beautifully expressive and also quite abstract. Erica looks like the type of heroine you'd gladly follow into hell, while the town and the people who live in it resemble the dreams and faded memories most of us possess of our past. JT has written a compelling tale that deals with the fantastic, but is grounded in perfect dialogue that sounds just like the people we hear in our everyday life. Also, the responses to the murders make sense. We've discussed this before, but when you want a reader or a viewer to embrace the craziness of something happening, you have to make the world relatable. You have to make the mundane parts be the things that you recognize from your own life. That way we can relate, and it also makes the horrific so much worse. The first volume covers the initial 5 issues, and I immediately went out and bought the second volume. I think it is better not to talk too much about what happens in the story for a number of reasons. It's a straightforward story. There's not too much going on, and that's not a complaint. It's streamlined, but to even sort of say, keep an eye out for this, I think maybe takes a little bit of the fun out of it. So I wouldn't want to give away anything. Like, I essentially knew the title, knew one of the 3 people creating it, and found out the name of the lead character. And even when I read the review, I kind of skimmed where it was talking about the minutiae of what was going on. So going in a little bit blind, I think, makes it a lot more fun. And I knew as much as I said at the start, basically. And when I started reading the title and I saw the name Erica Slaughter and her design, I thought, this is a home run for me. So I'll read the second volume this week and let you know what it's like in next week's podcast. If you've read it, let me know what you think over at our Facebook page. Maybe we'll talk a little bit more about the plot to this volume next week, which hopefully gives you enough time to go and check it out. And then if you haven't read it by then, that's all right. Then maybe talking about it will kind of entice you to go and check it out. But either way, I was a big fan of that first volume, and I'm looking forward to getting stuck into the second volume as soon as I can. Right. Let's talk about episode 4 of WandaVision.
What is it?
Some sort of energy field.
Be careful, Rambo. Captain Rambo. Watch it.
I think the start of this episode was one of the best starts to a TV show I've seen in a while. Maybe you would need some prior knowledge about Avengers Infinity War and Endgame, but I'm guessing if you're watching WandaVision, you're probably across that. Because the start of this episode, where we watch Monica reform when Thanos' snap is reversed, is an inspired moment of horror. One of the things that often drives me insane about these movies is that all these incredible things happen and you never really see how it affects other people. Like, you see how it affects the heroes and the villains and maybe some of the ancillary characters, but you, the normal people out there. And I look, don't get me wrong, I know Monica's not necessarily one of the normal people in this show. She is actually one of the heroes. But just sort of seeing her reform and seeing the hospital have to deal with it, it's amazing. Like, that's why I love the Dark Knight trilogy. Every action has a reaction. And so to see the reaction to that in the opening here was just an inspired moment. I loved it. And it is a moment of horror. Like, imagine if someone you loved disappeared, just disappeared, and you don't really know why at the time, and then eventually you discover that some superpowered alien snapped their fingers and made the person that you love not exist anymore, and then you'd grieve, you'd be in mourning, and then after 5 years you would have, in some ways, probably in most ways, begun to get on with your life. And then imagine if there's your husband, or oops, your dad's alive again, or what's that noise upstairs? The children are back. You see what I mean? Like, that is a moment of pure horror in a good way. Like, I'm not saying it's terrible, but how would you cope with that? And at the beginning of this, we see the chaos, as I said, in the hospital as people begin to reappear, but we see that Monica returns and realizes her mother has died. And in that moment, we also realize, if you've seen Captain Marvel, we've lost the character that was Carol Danvers' best friend. That's a heavy-hitting scene right there. And I hope there's more Marvel movies and TV shows that explore the ramification of people blinking in and out of existence, because that is a treasure trove of stories to be mined. Now, after 3 episodes of era-defining sitcoms through the lens of Wanda and Vision, we now see what is happening in the real world, and this type of storytelling was used to perfection by the creators at Lost. Here we see Monica return to life, and then she eventually returns to her work as an agent for S.W.O.R.D. Great acronym, stands for Sentient Weapon Observation Response Division, where she discovers she's grounded for terrestrial missions only. Terrestrial missions. That's interesting, isn't it? It's kind of a throwaway line, but it makes you think, well, that must mean there's space missions, and I wonder who could be working up in space on something. I wonder if it could be 4 fantastic heroes whose rights just returned to Marvel. Strokey beard meeting. Let's have a think about that. Then Monica is sent off to check out an anomaly with Jimmy Woo from Ant-Man and the Wasp. And it's great to see Jimmy has mastered a sweet magic trick that once dazzled him. It's a really funny moment. Took me a moment to actually realize how funny it was too. So Monica and Jimmy head out to the town called Westview, which is a town that shouldn't exist. It's never existed before, and Monica notices an energy field and touches the barrier, only to be drawn into this impossible town. Now, in the comics, Monica was a hero who could manipulate all types of energy and was originally a version of Captain Marvel. She was the African-American Captain Marvel, and she's also gone by the name of Photon later on. Monica was, just as a little side note, her version of Captain Marvel was in the Avengers when I started collecting it as a kid. So I'm extremely partial to this character. getting back to WandaVision, we have Darcy Lewis. She is brought to check out this barrier. It's great to see that character rescued from the abyss that is Thor the Dark World. And look, I actually don't want to get caught up in a complete recap here, but we're given explanations for the beekeeper and the colourful helicopter toy, and they're good explanations. As Darcy starts to study the field and starts to pick up on the sitcom vibe that's going on in there, we start to learn more and more about what's happening in this place. But of course, the revelation shouldn't be that much of a revelation. Like, I don't mean that as a negative, but the revelation is right there in front of us all along. And yes, Wanda appears to be creating this place to deal with her grief. None of this should be a surprise, because the series isn't called WandaVision for nothing. Like, it's not Wanda and the Vision, it's WandaVision. And that's just a little treat as to let you know where this series is going. That's a clever title too. I like that. I like that a lot. But it's still great to have what appears to be some of the important mysteries laid out for us. Because here's the thing. We are getting answers, but there's still a lot more questions. Like, what is going on with Catherine Hahn as Agnes? Is this a dream version of the Vision, or has Wanda possibly plucked him from an alternate reality? What is going on with all of the hexagons, including the shapes in Monica's boss's office? So good. Like, there's so much going on, and it does really keep you guessing. And the episodes go really quickly as well. And I enjoyed watching Darcy as she slowly starts looking into this world, and her interaction with Jimmy. All of that was great. The acting of Bettany and Olsen is still amazing, with Vision looking more and more uncertain about what is happening. And sometimes Wanda's steely gaze looking like a possessed Laura Palmer in the Black Lodge. Tiona Paris has been a favourite of mine for a while, since I saw her in Mad Men, so I'm rapt to see her get a great co-starring role here. And I'm really getting into the idea that Mephisto is being introduced as the new big bad. There were just some fun little kind of Easter eggs. The sheriffs who come from Eastview, and they have a number on their vehicle, which is 1966, which is one inverted number from 666. That could be a little stretch, but it seems interesting that that is there. I should have checked, actually. I wonder if Mephisto turned up in 1966 as well. Maybe I'll... Can I podcast and do podcasting at the same time? Let's have a look. First appearance. And, oh no, it was December 1968. Still, I was really excited then. Always good to be slightly off while still recording. But anyway, it could just be that the number's inverted. And as I was saying, the sheriffs come from Eastview, and hell is in the east. We also discover that WandaVision, the broadcast of the sitcoms that are happening in her world, they're hidden in the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is the leftover radiation from the early moments of the Big Bang. So could the devil be using the early moments of creation to manipulate the power of Wanda by giving her all she wants? What an absolutely fun show. And look, I'm trying to avoid speculating like I did with Watchmen. I was so engaged with that, and I was almost incapable of doing anything else. That series was so full on. And this one, I'm just trying to let it wash over me. But there's so many tasty moments. That's why I just want to do brief overviews, because these could be whole episodes by themselves. But I am really, really enjoying this. And I know some people are complaining that they have to wait a week before the next episode. And I say to you this, stop complaining. This is better. Take your time. Enjoy the show. You know what happens when you binge a show? You get the Stranger Things phenomena. You're excited. You watch it all. You've forgotten it 3 days later. I haven't even bothered to watch season 3 of that series, because I can't really remember anything that happened in season 2. It was in and out of my brain so quickly, it was like I never watched it. And I'm loving WandaVision, and I want to take my time. And I'm glad they're taking their time. I'm glad they're taking a chance. And they're taking the Marvel Universe into an exciting new era that has to be post-Iron Man and Captain America. Please head over to our Big Squid Facebook page to share your thoughts. And, you know, maybe if you want to speculate, throw some speculations this way and I'll read out the most interesting ones next week. And in the meantime, bring on episode 5. The Libsons are like many affluent suburban families in America in the 70s. The parents work hard and bring their children up in a rigid religious upbringing. Their 5 daughters are smart, charismatic, and a source of obsession for the boys in their neighborhood. Yet when the youngest sister, Cecilia, slits her wrists, the illusion of normalcy is shattered, and those who love the sisters will be forever haunted by their tragic endings. This is The Virgin Suicides.
What we have here is a dreamer, someone completely out of touch with reality. Lux, please, put your shirt on this instant.
Are you an aviation enthusiast?
I don't know if I'd call myself an enthusiast, but...
Do you like to wrestle?
Look, she's laughing. He made her laugh.
My intentions for your daughter are entirely honorable.
What might those intentions be?
So much has been said about the girls over the years.
Those girls have a bright future ahead of them.
But we have never found an answer.
Her act was a cry for help.
I heard it was an accident.
Even then, as teenagers, we tried to put the pieces together. We still can't.
We got a full tank of gas. We'll take you anywhere you want to go.
About time. We've been waiting for you guys.
You kind of already know this story, but last week I did a gig, which was a good gig for me, but overall was a pain in the ass.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, I really didn't feel like hanging out with anyone that was there.
Yep.
And they were like, oh, do you want to have a drink? Do you want to come and hang out? And I was like, nah. And I left and I came straight home. And I watched The Virgin Suicides, and I reckon in my 26, 27 years of performing, it's one of my top 3 decisions after a gig.
Yeah, what a way to end the night, right?
It was kind of good because it was, because the night had been flat.
Yeah.
I had a corker of a gig.
Yeah.
Like on a flat night, I had 2 applause breaks.
Beautiful.
Which is great.
Yep.
So I felt alive.
Mm-hmm.
I felt good.
Yep.
It was walking distance. I walked home. Adrenaline was up. I was focused. Put on The Virgin Suicides. At the end of it, went, nice one, Hammo. That has been a good choice.
So obviously you were able to fully lock in even after the adrenaline rush of the gig, right?
Yeah. It felt like I was just really present in the world.
Yeah.
And what a great movie to be present from the beginning to the end.
Totally. And you know, it's quite dreamy, so I'm sure it would have taken you along very nicely.
Yeah. And so I think you're like me. That was the first time you had ever seen it?
Yep.
Yeah.
So I watched it last night with my buddy who had seen it in 1999 at the cinema, who had a vague memory of it. And I think we started busting up laughing. It's very funny. We started laughing within the first minute and we're laughing the whole way through until the end.
Yes. No. But I've got that in, I think it's around the 3rd question, talking about the humour. So let's get into these points that I've written down for us and we'll go from there. But just as a random kind of question to start with, when you were a teenager, were you as mesmerised by the girls in your orbit like the boys are in this movie?
100%. 100%. Yeah. Yeah, I was a very overweight teenager, and so beyond just girls being out of reach in that kind of, you know, very standard teen way, they were kind of extra out of reach.
Right.
Like this was the mid-90s, you know. I was the only fat kid in the school. You know, now it's not so controversial, but back then it was like, well...
Mate, you're a precursor. Like, yeah, these kids are copying you, man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like with the comic books, I was completely ahead of my fucking time. But yeah, so... and every... I still remember all of their names. Every year from year 7 to 12, I would have a flame in my heart for a particular girl in my year.
Right.
And then there was one, my best friend, who, you know, was that whole kind of like... You know, I'm your best friend, but, you know, I'm in love with you. But you see me as your gay friend who you tell all of your secrets to. But I'm misreading that as we're connecting and one day we're going to get married. And so she was the kind of through line the whole way through. But every year there was an extra one as well. And it was always that just pining and the unrequited love and that real... There's a line in Virgin Suicides where the boys talk about how... I'm paraphrasing, can't really remember, but where they're talking about how they intuited very early on that these are not girls, they are women.
Right.
And they understand us, and to us, they are complete mysteries.
Yeah, completely unknowable. Yeah. And it's interesting, I felt like I was, so I feel like I'm somewhere in between with that, because some of my best friends in primary school, like, was a girl called Michelle Howe.
Hmm.
And Michelle and I hung out, and I honestly could say that between both of us, there was never any confusion over what we were. We were just mates.
Yeah.
And we hung out. We had a really good time.
Yeah.
And I think we even had, you know, with all these other friends, had one of those spin the bottle moments. And Michelle and I just looking at each other going, nah. Why would that happen? That would be weird.
Like making out with my sister.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it was such a moment where we both looked at each other and in that moment went, that's not happening.
But that's beautiful, you know, because it is rare at that age for a male and a female to be, a heterosexual male and female to be friends with each other, and for one or the other to not kind of have a secret longing.
Yes.
You know, because I obviously still believe this, you know, but even from a very young age was very much in that headspace of like, oh, how great would it be for your girlfriend to also be like your best buddy.
Yeah.
You know, just someone to goof off with and hang out with and have similar interests and all that stuff. Whereas that didn't seem to be very important to a lot of my other friends. It was like, is she hot? It was very hard to let go of that that unrequited love.
Yeah.
And in the end, after year 12, I confessed all this to my dear friend with the full expectation that she'd be like, yeah, I've been waiting 6 years for this moment. And it was just a very like clear cut, like, no.
Oh.
And it was devastating. And that was the end of our friendship, you know.
Oh,
it was that unrequited love that was kind of holding the whole thing, well, for me anyway, holding the whole thing together.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, if that had happened later in life and you confessed that, she would have been like, stop it, and then it's fine.
Yeah.
But when you're young, it's like everything seems to be, oh, well, if that's what you've been thinking, then how can this friendship continue?
Oh, it was me as well. You know, I was incredibly immature and petulant. And, you know, I remember when she said, you know, no, being like, but I like not even being able to compute how she couldn't feel the same way as me.
Right.
We're so close.
Right.
We're so close. We like love hanging out with each other. How could you not feel like that?
Yeah.
You know, obviously you get older and realize, well, it's not that fucking clear cut, buddy.
Yeah, it's just not. It's just not. It's interesting, isn't it? So I had quite a few female friends. I think it was because, you know, not only being raised by a single mum, but being around women.
Yeah.
And they, like, mum was 19 when she had me. Yeah. So the women I was hanging around were only, like, one generation removed from the girls that I was hanging out with. Yeah. So it just didn't seem that out there. I had the crush on the girl that I reckon lasted from grade 4 to grade 7. Like, it was pretty much the one that I thought was the... There might have been little moments of looking at other girls and thinking, oh, she's quite sweet and, oh, she's quite nice. Yeah. But that there was only the one that I kind of had, oh, she's perfect. But it's funny, the unrequited love, I honestly don't know if I've ever experienced that. And it's not because I'm a fucking winner, mate, and every chick I like likes me. But I think it's because there's... So I was brought up in such a way that just don't hassle girls. Just don't hassle women, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm not actually saying this is a positive skill to have. But I think if I kind of have an interest in someone, I will show them to a certain extent. And if they don't reciprocate, I've moved on so quickly that it's just like, oh, well, that's that.
Yeah.
But I do sometimes wonder if there have been times I have dated the wrong women because they've shown interest in me and I thought, oh, well, they've shown interest in me. I should date them.
100%. 100%. Yeah, absolutely.
So that's, you know, you're dating someone who is ostensibly nothing wrong with them, but...
They're just not for you.
We're not for each other. Not for each other.
No, absolutely. It's, waiting for that. But, you know, at that age, you know, you don't even know what reciprocity of feeling looks like.
Yeah.
And so it's very easy to mistake, you know, prolonged eye contact during a conversation for she likes me. I mean, it's that classic fucking dumb man thing of like, she smiled at me, she's in love with me. It's like, no, she's just a human being trying to be kind.
Right.
And you fucking completely misinterpreted this because you're a dumb dude with a brain full of cum.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it must be exhausting to be a female of any age having to deal with that.
Right.
It's just, you know.
Yeah, whereas I'm the opposite. And I used to do this as a joke on stage where girl could be sitting opposite me, pointing at me, holding up a big sign saying, I'm interested in you, and kind of making, sitting there, you know, with arms and legs and whole body kind of open and in an inviting way. And I'd lean over to you and go, what do you reckon? I'm not sure. I wish you'd give me a sign.
But what do you think that is? Do you think that's like innate self-loathing or like I'm not worthy or like what do you think that is? Because I do relate to that as well. As an adult, I relate to that. We were just talking before the mics.
Yes.
You know, there's three women in my lives where all signs, and I've subsequently found out I was correct, all signs pointed to yes.
Yeah.
And I did not have whatever it is, the courage or the self-worth or whatever, to kind of just say, hey, is this?
Yeah.
What is this?
Yeah.
You know, not in a bullying or oppressive way, but just in a...
Just asking the question.
Hey, like, you know, because there's a part of my head wondering what this is. Let's just clear this up so if it's not a thing, we can carry on. And if it is a thing, let's fucking have a great time together.
As someone who still feels acute embarrassment over telling Ross Murphy in grade 5 that when he used the word skit, it was pronounced sketch, I think it's just wanting to avoid embarrassment. And it's funny, it's the... In many ways, I deal with embarrassment really well. Like something could happen and you go, like I could drop a drink on myself in front of a girl and be like, oh, that's pretty cool. And I just would move on and I would be totally fine. Yeah. But if, you know, the times where you've sort of thought, oh, I think maybe this girl's interested and then she's not. And then there've been such small moments that still sit in the back of my head 100%. And I just don't want to have too many of them going 100%. On. So I just need to be, what's happening here, you know?
You know when you hear those grand gestures? Like a friend of mine, you know, was hanging out with a woman that he'd known for a very short amount of time. And they were watching a movie and he just held her hand. And they've been in a 6-year lovely relationship ever since. The idea of doing... Like, where do you get the fucking cojones to do that? Right. The idea of leaning in for a kiss and someone going, what are you doing? Is the most mortifying.
Oh my God.
You know what I mean? Even imagining it makes me want to fold in on myself and die. I just don't like, it's like a different, completely different species or mindset to be able to go there.
If we'd been videoing that little part of the discussion, people would have seen me literally look away from
you
because I couldn't even cope with that as an idea.
I saw your chest cavity cave
in. Oh my God, you are so right. That is one of the most mortifying things.
Can you imagine?
You can imagine.
What are you doing?
Oh no, I was just like... Like I accidentally touched an elbow with a female friend at the cinema and I'm like, I'm so sorry. Like I just like Tenet. Like, I'm sorry.
I'm not that guy.
It was kind of, you know, we'll get into the movie really properly soon, but it did kind of bring up a lot of wonderful memories of the girls that I went to, specifically primary school, maybe a little bit early high school.
Yeah.
And it was like... I mentioned Michelle Howe before, and I had not thought of Michelle in a long time. And, you know, she had two older brothers who were into fucking Cold Chisel, mate. And they love footy, and they love Port Adelaide Magpies. And, you know, I'm sure Michelle and I would not have much in common now. But she was a cool girl. You know, we used to just hang out and do things together. And it did make me think about, you know, those crushes where you... you know, there's... You go through these different types of crushes as well. Where you, there's the crush on the person that you think you should have a crush on. And then there's like the first time you have the crush on the girl that is, whoa, like I've got a crush on her. Where did that come from? And because these girls are all represented in the sisters in so many different ways, and you're sort of sitting there. Just, oh, yeah, no, I recognize her. I recognize her. I recognize her. I recognize her. Did you have that same experience?
100%. Yeah. Actually, what you just said about the, you know, the girl that you never expected to have a crush on. That, you know, I'm suddenly thinking of someone that I hadn't thought of in many, many years. But yeah, of course. It's, and where your mind goes at that age, you know. Like, I mean, I can't speak for other guys because I never lived in their heads. But for me, it was never even about, you know, I always just wanted to smooch. It was never even like, you know, once I got into mid high school, you know, guys started talking about, I want to have sex. And I was like, I just want to make out and cuddle and have a nice relationship. And every girl I would fall in love with, it was these, you know, projected fantasies into the future of how we'd get together. And then when we were in our mid 20s, we'd get married. And it was like these real, like elaborate fantasies that I'm not, other guys I've spoken to didn't seem to go down that path.
Well, the complete irony of being 48 and single and childless was that as a youngster, I was going to meet the love of my life, get married, be a good husband, have kids, be a good dad. It was a real, I'm just going to do that. And that never happened. Thank goodness I wouldn't have been able to see Tenet as often as I did at the cinema. I gave up on the dream of Juzzy Jr. to have a full love affair with the movie. So at the beginning of this film sets up that really dreamy and romanticized view of 70s suburban America, but Coppola cuts straight to the inside of the house, and it's flat and it's beige, and the only color that you kind of aware of is the blood on Cecilia's wrist. And this is a really confronting scene, yet it's only a few minutes later after a failed suicide attempt that I laughed so hard when Cecilia's doctor says, you're not even old enough to know how bad life gets. And she replies, obviously, doctor, you've never been a 13-year-old girl. Were you surprised by the humor in this? Because I didn't have, I can't say that I had expectations, but I was like, oh, this is much funnier than I realized.
Yeah, well, I didn't even know what the movie was about. I had no...
Neither did I.
No premise, nothing.
It went slipped in completely by blind. Me when it came.
Yeah. So I didn't have any expectation. It obviously we'll get to this in a few movies time, but I really love the Sofia Coppola film, The Beguiled.
Yeah.
I don't know if have you seen this?
I haven't seen that one.
You'll fucking love it. And that has a very similar humor to it. Just kind of understated, you know, droll. So as soon as that line happened, I was like, oh, okay, it's the same director, and here we go. And me and my buddy were howling the whole way through.
Yeah.
And that laughter of, you know, not just these sequences are funny and these lines are well delivered, but that resonance, the truth of so much of it.
Yeah.
You know, the way that 13-year-old with, I can't remember his name, but the really cool 13-year-old that throws himself off the roof for unrequited love, you know, the way he's strutting along.
Yeah,
you know,
falls in the bushes and just kind of rearranges his sunglasses and keeps strutting. Struts
off again.
Yeah.
Like all that stuff was very, because I've only seen this, Lost in Translation, and The Beguiled. I don't remember anything about Lost in Translation, but from what I remember, she has a way of capturing something true about being alive that is very hard to even put into words.
Oh, yeah. Like, you know, that first time you see Trip Fontaine, and like the even the scripting is beautiful where it's like, it's such a throwaway, but it's essentially he was the fat kid who got abs over summer and shot up, and then the music that's playing and the haircut and it's all picture perfect. And I laughed at that moment because it was like, oh, this is glorious.
I
completely understand that kid in a few seconds of you setting him
up. And in metaphor, that the way that is shot is how us who maybe were fat and dumpy all through high school saw that guy.
Right.
You know, strutting in slow motion, the perfect hair, you know. Again, it captures a truth that's very difficult to put into words.
Yeah.
It is, you know, captured in visual metaphor and music and everything. Yeah. By the way, Trip Fontaine, maybe one of the greatest names I've ever heard in my life. I couldn't get over that for about 5 minutes.
Oh.
Trip Fontaine.
It was so perfect when I first heard it, I thought I'd misheard it.
Yeah.
It's like, how can letters be gathered together in such an exquisite form? Trip Fontaine. So good. Anyway, I do want that son now. I'll call him Trip Hamilton. So the parents played by Kathleen Turner and James Woods. But James Woods was so good in this, I forgot that I hated him in real life.
Man, what a fucking tragedy that James... I said that to my buddy halfway through. It was the moment where he walks up to the plant and he's like, having some photosynthesis for breakfast, and we couldn't stop laughing.
Right.
And I turned to my friend, I was like, what a fucking tragedy that this guy lost his mind. He is so good. And he's so good.
So good when the guy... What is it? The principal asks him where the daughters have been, and he's like, have you looked out the back? Like the way he says it. He's even because he's as boring as fuck.
Yeah.
And the way he delivers all of his stuff while he's quite clearly boring these kids.
Yeah.
Never overacts it. Never.
It's an amazing performance considering his other body of work where, you know, he plays maybe not hyper masculine men, but I've never seen him play a role like that. This kind of like, you know, submissive, cowed 70s dad. And it was just perfect. The nuance of it and the little looks and, you know, everything. The gurning to camera, fantastic.
And I've always loved Kathleen Turner.
Yep.
And Kathleen Turner in this role of this oppressive, you know, can't express herself kind of character. To me, this will sound like a weird reflection, but it was like watching James Caan in Misery, who's this hyperkinetic actor who's trapped in a bed, and you can feel it. Like, you can feel...
Yeah.
And her being this amazing woman and this amazing actor and just completely repressed and incapable of busting out was a masterclass in acting. I thought she was amazing.
Yeah, and a great choice because that role would have been so easy to play as, you know, Carrie's mum. You know, just hyper hysterical, religious bigot, all that kind of stuff. So to go the opposite direction and play it real, even right, you know, towards the end of the movie where she's locking them in the house and everything. I mean, you could really ramp up the hysteria in the performance around that part of the movie, and it's not.
Yeah.
Like, it's that real repression.
You know, this was never... it was always a series that I felt like had the potential for greatness, but never quite got there. And it was... the David Duchovny series, Californication.
I never saw it.
I always, especially early on, I thought it had some interesting things and I felt like it was going somewhere interesting. And I think, anyway, this is not a Californication podcast, but anyway, one of the things that I actually thought was underrated and incredibly progressive about it was that Kathleen Turner was in it. And she, you know, she's had bad health over the years and she looks very different to when she was younger.
Mm.
But they just played her as, like, she was this, like, super sexually charged woman.
Yeah, great.
And she started having an affair with Duchovny's agent and was destroying him.
Yeah.
And I always found that to be, and I'd be curious to know what people think, I always found that to be an underappreciated progressive moment in popular entertainment because it's like, she doesn't look like Susan Sarandon.
Yeah.
Like, she's looking her age, but it's great because it's Kathleen Turner and she's such a good actor and it's funny.
Yeah.
And
isn't it interesting when things like that happen and they don't make a big fuss about it and for some reason it is just not remarked upon ever? It just kind of goes under the radar.
Yeah.
You know, and it is very progressive.
Yeah, and it's like, hey, you don't have to look like like, you don't have to look 25 years younger to play a woman of that age who was still sexually active.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
And that's a really good message. Anyway, maybe it was missed because it was in Californication and it didn't have enough other stuff going on. But anyway.
And every time I hear that voice, takes me back to Who Framed Roger Rabbit. My Lord.
Oh, yeah.
My Lord.
Yeah.
Great voice.
So the parents are played by Turner and Woods. They're strict Catholics who love their daughters but don't allow phone calls, parties, sleepovers or boys to invade their world. They even dress the girls in similar clothes that make them appear to be sexless and kind of the same age. Like they kind of make them a little bit ageless.
And cultish.
What do you think is the biggest mistake the parents make with their girls? Is there one...
Locking them in the house and never letting them do anything?
Well, that's like, you know, like... That's definitively, but what is, do you think it's the, by, so the reason I asked that question is because I was trying to work out where does it start going wrong? And it's I think it's, of course, the physical act of locking them away.
Yeah.
But just even letting them hang out with boys is just such an important thing when they're younger, because it would have, in a way... One of the most telling moments in the movie for me is when they go to the prom.
Yeah.
And when they're in the car with the boys and you hear them talking, they're talking about all the things that everyone would be talking about. Oh, look what they've done with that front yard. Oh, that's a bit ostentatious, isn't it?
You know.
And they're just like, oh, at that point you're going, they're just teenage girls. And I think if they'd been able to... be able to hang out with boys their own age, it would have taken a bit of the demystification away.
Yes, I think, you know...
By cutting them off from that, they made them more to the boys and to everyone else when...
Totally.
They could have just been...
Totally. I think one of the biggest mistakes parents make, and this is obviously very easy for me to say because I don't have children, is... And I understand this would be a very, very difficult thing to do, but there must come a time where you accept the fact that life hurts, it's going to bruise you and it's going to fuck you up, and that's not a bad thing. And to shelter people growing up from those realities of life is not to help them in any way. It's just to delay the inevitable.
Yeah.
It's not to give them any kind of emotional or armor to navigate this stuff. And so I think the original sin is just that kind of control.
Yeah.
Trying to control every aspect and, you know, oh, my wonderful baby can never experience just the realities of life.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what inevitably leads to, you know, the horrific ending of this film.
Yeah, yeah. And mistakes in general, you know, in other aspects of life. The I've been listening to the Scary Monsters album. I just hadn't really listened to it for a while, and I was listening to that. And there's a lesser-known song on it called Because You're Young, and it's kind of like Bowie singing to his son, who would have been like a teenager at the time. And ostensibly, the song is about... Hey, you're going to have this happen, you're going to have that happen, and I really hope these bad things don't happen. But you know what? I'm this age, and they're going to happen.
Yeah, they're going to happen.
And you're young, and it's going to be okay.
Yeah, they're going to happen. Yeah. You see it on, you know, like the difference between the parent who, when their kid falls over and whatever, scrapes their knee or even breaks their leg, just goes into hysteria, you know, as though it's happened to them, or as though there's nothing to be gained from this experience, as though it's a 100% traumatic, awful experience that is, you know, going to scar them for life, as opposed to this is it, you know, shit happens and how you deal with it after the fact is the true measure of your character.
Yeah.
Up you get.
Yeah.
And you see it all the time, you know, when kids fall over, they... You know, the bottom lip goes, the quivering starts, and they look to the adult, whichever adult's closest to them. What's the adult's reaction? Is the adult like, oh, you're fine, up you get. Cool, up we get. Yeah, and it hurts.
Yeah.
Not diminishing the fact that it hurts.
Yeah.
But, you know, this will happen a million times throughout your life. You will fall on your ass over and over. And, you know, I think... I understand the motivation in not wanting to see a child... suffer in any way.
Yeah.
But it's a very reductive Disney view of reality.
Yeah.
You know, life has sharp edges and you got to get used to it.
Yeah. You know? The it's a shame as well because especially when you see these girls, it's so funny that they look so similar, they're dressed similarly, all of that, and in it's not a very long film either, and in such a perfect amount of scenes and words, I felt like I knew each girl, like they felt really defined to me, and it was. You know, but there were a couple of them that were, I thought, really funny and really, really on top of things in ways that no one else really understood. And that's kind of the tragedy as well, is like you're looking at a lot of these girls and thinking, oh my God, like you could have all been brilliant doing all these amazing things.
Yeah. There was a point, you know, obviously they flag in the first minute of the film what's going to happen by the end.
Yeah,
but I truly about three.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What is the way through? Believe that it wouldn't.
Right.
I really, you know, it was like, no, they're, you know, they're... I don't know, whatever. They'll be able to push through this hardship and get to the other side, but it, evidently.
Yeah, that's interesting. There was a moment where I wondered if it was a metaphor.
Yeah.
And then as it progressed, you went, oh, no metaphors.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were just talking about how the sisters are physically presented as almost perfect replicas of each other.
Mm.
But we also realized that we learned their definitive personalities. Out of the sisters... Which is one you think you would have gravitated towards?
Kirsten Dunst.
Oh, right.
Well, just because she's funny.
Yes.
She's really funny.
Yeah.
And she knows who she is. Super confident.
That's funny. I would have been, I reckon it was the eldest, Mary.
Right.
But she was also, for the same reasons, she was funny. Like, you know, when the young guy's like... trying to talk to her.
Oh,
yeah. We don't have to talk. And as soon as she said that, I was like, that would have been my friend and she would have been telling me, oh, God, you should have seen. And I would have been like, yeah. But it's funny that we both picked the girls with the senses of humor.
Yeah, of course. I remember seeing a movie sometime. What movie is this? Where, again, a very religious, controlling parent says to the daughter, you know, don't be funny. Boys don't like funny girls.
Oh, yes.
It's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, one of the worst lessons. It always makes me lose 15% respect for any of my male friends who say anything close to that.
What is how weak? Like, really? You're threatened by a female being funny? That's fucking lame, dude.
Right.
What's wrong with you?
Like, don't you want to hang out with someone who says it's something funny. That makes you laugh?
Yeah, it's great.
It's a really good feeling.
It's great.
And it doesn't have to be a competition.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Not everything needs to be a fucking dick measuring contest.
It doesn't mean you can't get a hard on anymore.
Yeah.
It's just because she was funny.
Yeah.
Should be wrapped.
Absolutely.
I told you, I saw Judith Lucy and Denise Scott last night.
Yeah.
Fuck, it was great.
Yeah, it's great. Fuck yeah.
Like, they're two of the best comedians this country's ever produced, and they're on stage together.
Yeah.
Just riffing.
Yeah, great.
And it was mesmerizing. It was so good. So, funnily enough, your answer about Kirsten Dunst's character, Lux. Mm. So, I'm not saying that I wouldn't have noticed her, but at that age, because of the way other boys were sort of drawn to her, that's exactly why I wouldn't have been.
Right. Okay.
So, not in a defiant or... I'd just go... Like, there were girls at my school that I would see the way some boys were around, and I would be like, I'll say hello, but I'm not going
to... Because you didn't want to make her have to endure one more dude going...
Well, I also, this gets back to the embarrassment thing. I didn't want to be mistaken for one of those boys
Yeah.
I would have been hanging out with Mary and having a more relaxed time, laughing about stuff.
Oh, yeah, not wanting to be mistaken. There was someone I was so deeply in love with in my early 20s, and maybe something could have happened. I don't know, but she was one of those women who every dude fell in love with her.
Yeah.
And I was adamant to not be one more
guy
that was hanging out and then eventually going, I like you. Like, don't do that to her.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I mean, and I think that's a good, I think that's a really good impulse.
Yeah.
But I do, you know, it is one of those ghosts of Christmas past as I turn 40 this year. It's like, right. Oh, what could have been if you just gone over? Not in a, you know, putting it on her of like, please make me happy kind of way.
No, but
just kind of, you know,
where
opening
the
up the conversation a little bit. Yeah, would it have gone?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the girls are subjected to not just the male gaze of their high school peers, but also the gaze of their parents and the adults in the neighbourhood. How do you think the girls would have survived in modern times where, in many respects, people can own the way people look at them through social media? I'm not saying everyone can, but there's a lot of women who will just, this is who I am, and I'm just going to show it. And it was funny watching it thinking, wow, these girls are in the 70s.
Yeah.
What would they have been like in 2020 and having Instagram at their hands? And like, who would have found a way to express themselves and maybe gotten themselves out of that situation, who would have been maybe in a worse situation?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, obviously there's no shyness in communicating, like at the end when there's, you know, the light, the Morse code with the lights and the records over the phone. You would have to assume if they each had a phone, well, first of all, their parents probably wouldn't have allowed them to have those devices, but if they did... you know, I imagine it would have been a lot more vocal. Have you ever, you know, Kellyanne Conway, Trump's senior advisor or whatever she was?
Yeah.
Her daughter is very, very, very vocal on Instagram.
Right.
And is always, you know, talking about how awful Trump is. And,
oh, yes. I have seen that. Yeah.
So, I mean, I imagine it would have been something similar to that. Just kind of the empowerment to push back.
Yeah.
But, you know, in terms of presenting who you are on social media, I blanch against that just in the sense of I think it's, for the most part, either a construct that maybe bears some similarity to reality, but, you know, is performative by its very nature. And also, I think on social media, people, particularly those people who decide that they're going to, you know, dear diary every fucking thought they've ever had and put it online. I don't think that they realize they are revealing aspects of themselves that they aren't aware that everyone's reading into.
Oh, yeah. I don't discount any of that.
Yeah.
But I also think that these girls in these modern times, it may have given them... Like, even if what they're showing is performative, like, Lux, I think, would have been performative.
Yeah.
But that might have... given her even more power to...
Sure.
Like, that performance doesn't necessarily mean you're being weak. It just means she could have controlled a little bit more. I kind of feel like Mary would have been able to kind of control aspects of her life a little bit more. But I said Mary was the eldest before. It's actually Therese. Therese, who was the eldest, who was just... she seemed really sweet. I kind of think, oh, she might have... struggled a little bit.
And you know, so much of it's dependent on the external feedback that's coming from each post.
Yeah,
you know, like if you've got a 1,000 followers going, yeah, this is a fucked situation, it reaffirms this thing that you probably suspect.
Yeah,
but you know, in the late 70s, you know, isn't as kind of full on as it would be now.
Coppola does an amazing job of using humour, as we said, to show us the way the boys fumbled their encounters with the girls and how they view them from afar. Do you remember what your friends were like when they were first mixing with girls their age? I remember, I think I was pretty lucky. So this made me think, this made me think about this a lot. Once again, it's not something I've thought about for a while. And I feel like the close friends, like the really good friends of mine, were all pretty good. I think they were brought up really well, and nothing was overtly, like, I'm not saying that there weren't missteps, you know, but it was all pretty respectful, and it made me feel really good about my upbringing, those friends, to go, oh yeah, they were all kind of fine. Yeah, you know?
Well, our group of friends in high school was completely intermixed. It wasn't like the boys sit on one end of the playground. Yes. You know, it was so there was a lot of friendships before, you know, and of course everyone was, you know, you're teenagers, so everyone's lusting after each other.
Right.
But it was very strange at my school. For some reason, it was very... It wasn't a religious school. There was no morality attached to it. But for some reason, our grade was very conservative when it came to making out. I mean, I remember the first person... who knows? It could have happened without anyone realizing. But the first time it was a known fact that someone had lost their virginity, I think it was the tail end of year 11.
Right.
And it was like, whoa!
Right.
Whoa, they had sex. I mean, we were still playing giddy... ironic games of spin the bottle in year 12.
Right.
You know, the way kids, you know, probably do in year 8 now,
yeah.
Where it was like, oh my God, I can't believe we're doing this, you know. But and having to create a framework for it, for getting all this, you know, high-end hormonal energy out.
Yeah.
You know, again, I don't know. I wasn't one of the girls in my year, so it's probably a very different experience. But I don't remember a lot of lechery and grubbiness. I mean, there was definitely one guy in our year that was a known creep.
Yeah. And that was the biology teacher.
Well, yeah. Actually, the ancient history teacher.
Right.
Yeah. Real grot.
Yeah. You know, I think I was talking about this with a friend the other night. I was a real floater in high school. So I'd hang out with the nerds and play Dungeons and Dragons, and then a couple of weeks later I'd be hanging out with the Asian kids playing Happy Sack, and then I'd be hanging out with the cool girls, and then I'd be hanging out with the rough boys, and then I'd be playing basketball, and I just never really stayed in one group for a long time. And I wonder if never been invited to a school reunion either. And it's like, for fuck's sake, I'm the guy with the highest profile. Jesus Christ. Like, I know Limo. Surely you want to talk to me.
Would you go?
I don't know.
My 20 year one was last year, and I didn't. I couldn't do it.
No, I don't know how I would have, you know, but like, fucking invite me. but I wonder if maybe I missed bad aspects of behavior.
Yeah.
Because I was floating. So like, obviously, I would get to a point where I'd start to think, whew, this is getting full on. All right, time to move on.
So
I wonder if I have this kind of, in many respects, maybe a slight naive teenage history to a certain extent, because I never stayed long enough to start seeing the degradation of a group and therefore the bad behavior that would come.
Yeah, maybe. It definitely sounds different from school to school. You know, a person I work with who's exactly my age, you know, she talks about her high school. Everyone was on acid and smoking.
Yeah.
And honestly, there was one girl in year 12 that started smoking, and we all thought she was a fucking loser.
Right.
Like, why did you do that? Right. Again, I don't know why. It was a very kind of, you know, we were naughty. We were definitely mischievous and very naughty.
Right.
And always up to schemes.
Yeah.
But it wasn't that stock standard stuff you hear from high school about, you know, people smoking cones in the bushes and...
You know, sometimes I wonder, something that we underestimate is, I wonder if there'd been a really good advertising campaign in the lead up to that stuff. So... I remember, funnily enough, Limo used to have a really funny joke, like a really, really funny routine in 99 about drink driving and getting caught and, you know, blowing a cricket score. And it had heaps of jokes, and it killed.
Yeah.
It was a killer routine. And 18 months later, he was getting nothing. And it took us ages to work out. There'd been a big campaign in 2000 of... drink drive, you're a bloody idiot.
Right.
And things had changed. So maybe when you got into school, that maybe there'd been effective anti-smoking campaign.
I believe the anti-smoking was because all our parents smoked. And in that classic way, it was just like, that's fucking lame because our parents do it.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, a lot of 20-year-olds I know now are full-on smokers.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they all credit that from Mad Men.
Right.
They all grew up watching Mad Men and thought smoking was cool.
Well, look.
Or plus, you know, they were probably rebelling against the Remember those vile anti-smoking campaigns in the early 2000s? You know, the amputated leg on the bus, and like you couldn't. It's like fuck off. This is actually violence, psychic violence. I don't smoke, and I don't need to see a fucking amputated foot at 7 o'clock in the fucking morning. Get out of my face.
Yeah,
and I wonder if there's a rebellion against that where people are like, "Don't tell me not to fucking smoke."
Yeah, and also, why is that person smoking with their toes?
Yeah.
I don't know how it works. Anyway. So I had to ask you about this. I saved this for a little bit later into the questions. What did you think of Scott Glenn's priest moving through the house without anyone really wanting him there? Oh my God. Like, did that not just creep you out?
Yeah. Especially a Catholic priest wandering through a house, kind of uninvited. You know, the dad did tell him no one wants to talk to you. Well, I'm going to go and talk to them anyway.
Right.
Presumptuous.
And he's such a good actor as well. Yeah. And there's just this insouciance of the way he's... It says a lot about them as a family that they would, you know, like James Woods ostensibly ignores him because he's just trying to watch TV and that's all he wants to do.
Yeah.
But there's that scene when he comes in and he speaks to Kathleen Turner and she's got her back to them, her.
Yeah,
and
it's
kind of a, that one shot looked like it could have been in a horror movie.
Totally. And it was almost like a denunciation of their own faith. You know, because, I mean, when would you need to talk to... If you were a staunch Catholic, when would you need to talk to a priest more than when your daughter has just died? Especially in the manner in which she died.
Oh, my Lord. You
know, according to Catholic tradition, she's burning in the river Styx right now.
Yeah.
And yet, they don't want a bar of it. They go to ground and they all, you know...
Yeah. Well,
obviously, the daughters all support each other. And then it's interesting that the parents are completely separated.
Yes.
Upstairs and downstairs. It's an amazing piece of acting from James Wood where he's watching the baseball game, but every so often you see his eyes focus from the TV just to the middle distance.
Yeah.
And he's lost in the horror of the situation, and suddenly it's too much, and he's back to the game.
Yeah, and he's complaining about something happening there.
Brilliant bit of acting.
Yeah, I found it was such a small part of the film, but it really lingered with me afterwards, and the way, just that, what does he say? He kind of covers it up.
I said it was an accident.
Yeah.
As though you can trick God.
Yeah, right?
Hey, God, she didn't kill herself. It was an accident. Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I was just looking over.
Get her out of hell into heaven.
Yeah, sorry. I was just answering some prayers at the Middle East, and it was really hard because I was answering heaps of different people who all wanted different things, and I missed what happened. So that's a terrible accident.
It does seem to me. I've always blanched against that notion that you can... And it does... I don't know if it's like the whole idea of confession and everything, but it's always like, you know, you can't trick... The omnipresent, like if the God is the God that you believe in, this omnipresent, omniscient, father figure, you really think you can pull a swift one on him? What are you fucking talking about?
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah, it's
like, where's the conviction of your own belief to think that you can trick God?
I would find it completely entertaining, except for all of the terrible things it has made happen.
Absolutely.
In the world.
Well, you know, there's that notion that you can, you know, do whatever the fuck you want. And as long as you go, sorry, it's all good.
A few Hail Marys. I'm back, baby.
Yeah, I'm back.
Speaking of horrible, any thoughts on Lydia Pearl's reporter who keeps turning up?
Oh, yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. That was really... Yeah, I liked that it was, this real criticism of, you know, parasitical media, but without kind of banging on about it. Just another little theme bubbling away in the background.
And once again, like, I think, you know, as soon as the movie finished, the predominant thing that I thought about was the male gaze, but the thing that kind of tied it all together was... Cecilia saying you've never been a 13-year-old girl and realizing, no, it's not just the male gaze. The male gaze is important to discuss in this film, but it's the neighbors, it's the reporters. Like, there's a really funny scene actually when they're chained to the tree and she says, I want to get a shot of the girls to the tree, and the girls have already left.
Yeah.
And she just starts reporting.
Yeah. Without even turning back to see if they're still there.
They're still there. what a delightfully awful character.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts about the elm trees being cut down because they may have Dutch elm disease? Because I'm guessing the trees represent how the girls are gradually dying from the way they're being treated. That's how I read that.
Yeah.
And if they save that tree, they can kind of save themselves.
Yeah, there's that. I also wonder if, you know, preemptively cutting down the tree is, you know, it just in case something awful happens is almost a metaphor for the suicides, you know.
Right.
Let's take ourselves out before, you know, instead of just seeing what happens. maybe it'll rot, maybe it won't.
Yeah, but maybe it'll be fine.
Maybe it'll be fine. But yeah. Nah, let's just fucking lop it down anyway.
Yeah. Well, Dutch elm disease is, in a way, representative of the disease. The way the neighbourhood looks at the girls after Cecilia's death, like now they have that disease and they don't want their kids.
Yeah.
Like it's going to pop from each kid to their own kid. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, that famous phrase that I assume, because I've known this phrase for, you know, most of my life, I assume it predates this movie, but that really famous phrase, you know, it's 3 p.m. Do you know where your children are?
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that seemed to kind of...
I think I know that from my youth as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, that seems to kind of cover that idea of like, oh my God, is this some kind of mind virus that's now going to spread through the through the town? Is this the new trend?
even the removal of the fence, you know, like it's this... really very safe suburban area and there's still this fence that's caused this awful moment of death and then all the men being there incapable of getting it out and they have to literally get a truck to remove it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, like all the family around gawking, like this is... Hey, what are you doing today? I'm going to go down and watch the fence get removed. Yeah, oh, yeah, I'll bring milk and cookies.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And there's actually, speaking of fucking horror movie shot, it really upset me. It was like a Lynch shot where it suddenly cuts to a couple of women watching and then this other woman with a tray of lemonade just kind of glides past the camera with this weird disembodied smile on her face.
Yes,
and it really upset me. It was just like, what is this? What's going on?
Yeah, and everyone's so judgmental, but nobody... So I've been... We should talk about this at some point in a different podcast, I'm about to embark on a reread of Grant Morrison's The Filth.
Oh, I just did that.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, did you?
I did.
Maybe that's what inspired me. Anyway, that's interesting that you say that.
I used it as my toilet book for a while. I thought it highly appropriate to read that while taking a shit.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. I feel like he'd be totally into knowing that as well. But, you know, in many ways, so I'll just touch on it now.
Yeah.
But there's a really interesting statement in that graphic novel, which is if you don't connect with society, you're just focusing on yourself, you're actually doing the wrong thing.
Yep.
Like you, and if you don't like the way the world is, then you have to embrace it and you have to be a part of it to make some sort of positive change.
Yep.
And it's interesting, all these people, like they'll come and remove the fence, but no one's knocking on the door
100%.
And saying, can I help out? Or do you need to talk to someone?
Yeah,
or
can I make you dinner?
Yeah. Hey, why don't I take the girls to somewhere?
Yeah.
You know, everyone's just watching from afar with these firm views.
Yeah.
But no one has any solutions.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which, you know, does... I guess that's the kind of the horror cliche of suburbia.
Yeah.
You know, the facade of perfection, but really, you know, behind the white picket fence. You know, that the classic... shot at the beginning of Blue Velvet.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Just under the surface, it's all these filthy insects cannibalizing each other.
Yeah, yeah. Eating an ear.
Yeah.
The narration reveals the boys in the neighborhood are still haunted by the girls, even as the boys become adults.
Mm.
The narrator even mentions when they catch up as grown-ups, they still talk about the girls. That time hasn't diminished their memories in any way. Mm. Is that... because in spite of their amateur detective work, the girls will always be a mystery? Or is this just an example of them being trapped in a type of arrested development, or maybe a bit of both?
Bit of both.
Yeah.
Yeah. And and almost the comfort of nostalgia, even if what your nostalgias are what you're being nostalgic over is kind of awful.
Yeah.
You know, the lens of youth. I mean, you know, I think that's really brought home when it... because the only present day scene we have is of Trip Fontaine.
Yeah, in rehab.
In rehab, very diminished.
Yeah.
You know, and as awful as that time was, it seems like it maybe, at least it was still rich with possibility and mystery rather than now when everything's very concrete and, you know, oh, I am what I am, and this is the age I am, and there's very little ahead of me.
Yeah.
Whereas back then, it's, you know, infinite possibility.
So yeah.
It's easy to kind of go back and...
Well, he romanticizes
the part. He romanticizes it.
Yeah. Yeah, and he treated her awfully.
Yeah, he's a fucking prick.
Oh.
Like, and they're just in that typical, you know, way. You got what you wanted, and all of a sudden it was, I've got it. And the only reason I wanted it was because it was dangled in front of me.
Yeah.
And not, you know, a guaranteed thing that I could just snap my fingers and get.
Yeah. I thought that was really well presented because I did believe that he wasn't awful.
Ah.
Like, you know, in the lead up, I was like, oh, I think this guy has been, you know, like, I believe this is what he's feeling. And then when she wakes up by herself and you go, motherfucker. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good work, Sophia Coppola.
Yeah, it was all cum.
Yeah.
It was all cum driving that, those decisions.
I also found the fact that they stole the discarded family photos.
Yeah.
Like, they all kind of took these remnants. I found that fascinating.
Yeah.
That even after all this terrible stuff has happened, they're still grabbing these, the flotsam jetsam of their lives to still try and hold on to it in some way.
Well, the fact that the family photos are thrown in the garbage as though it never happened, as though there never was the family down the memory hole.
Yeah, they got someone else to, you know, pack up the place and move on.
It's the, you know, it's the extreme polar opposite of those people that leave the child's bedroom exactly as it was on the day they died.
Yeah.
You know, maybe both extremes are a bit sick.
Yeah, yeah. There's got to be somewhere in between, right? Actually, while I think of it, do you have any sympathy for a grown-up Trip Fontaine?
Oh, like, in the sense of, like, you know, life is complicated and, you know, I don't think anyone's, other, you know, unless you're a clinical psychopath, no one's fucking that evil. And, you know, I mean, look, you can't, I know that the politics of the day is very keen on holding people to account for things that they did 30, 40 years ago. And in some cases, that's completely justified.
Yeah.
In another case, you know, judging the actions of a 16-year-old, 15-year-old boy who is, as far as I'm concerned, barely human at that point.
Right. Well, so the reason I ask is because even though I didn't want to get past the fact that the one scene that we see of his life, I couldn't work out which one his dad was.
I thought they were both his dads.
Right.
Yeah.
And they were letting him drink.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's like, well, you're not quite, like, not making excuses for him, but I understand that that kid's journey from being the fat kid to suddenly being that, you know, not knowing how to deal with it because he's never had any lead up to it. These dads who don't, like, you know, they're doing what they think is their best, but they're letting him drink and giving him, what, mimosas or something at such a young
age. Always
and now he's in rehab.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
It's good complexity.
There's a tragedy to his life. Look, I don't think, you know, all you can judge the character on is what you see in the movie. He never does anything that is illegal or so hate. Like, he never does anything in the film that is outside the general parameters of just shitty teenage behavior.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He doesn't sexually assault anyone.
No.
You know, he doesn't force himself on Lux. When he's asked to leave, he leaves.
Yeah.
You know, he seems real stoked when she comes out to the car and makes a move on him.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, no, I don't condemn that guy to hell.
No.
He was just a dumb teenager.
Yeah. The girls are presented in dreamy shots where they often appear larger than life to the boys who adore them. When they read the swipe diary of Cecilia, they know that these girls are women who have much more interesting things in mind, like where to travel, the friends they could have had, and the love that they shared. Yet between the boys, the gossip of the neighbourhood, and the ongoing news reports, we witness the girls being trapped by expectation and not respected for who they really are. In your dealings with the kids that you work with, are we making any progress in that aspect of life?
I'm so sorry I vagued out.
You know, that's one of the favourite things that people listen to is the you vagging out all the moments where you forget what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
that's often.
They are highlights.
I'm sorry.
Have a drink if you're listening.
Sorry. Go again.
No. You know what? I'll just say, are we getting better at making... With the kids that you work with...
Yeah.
I'm not going to go through that again. That was too much. In the kids that you work with, are we getting better at bringing up girls in a way where they're not trapped by these expectations that aren't realistic.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yes, I think so. The fact that there's a lot more dialogue about it, the fact that there's, multiple ways, and I would say it's the same for boys. You know, there's multiple accepted or increasingly accepted. We're not 100%, we'll never be 100% there, but we're getting better at widening the parameters of what a boy or a girl can be.
Yeah.
And offering distinct possibilities outside of, when I was, and I'm sure you had a very similar thing, although you like some sport, but when I was in high school, the fact that I didn't like sport, it was like, you are a fucking freak.
Right.
People just thought they couldn't get their head around it.
Yeah.
Which of course just galvanized me and made me even more belligerent and like, I'll never like it. out of spite. Whereas now that's fine.
Yeah.
The very fact that so many girls now are into video games and comic book culture, just as an example.
Yes.
You never saw that 20 years ago.
Oh, no, not at all.
So I think we're getting better at understanding that there are multiple ways to be that aren't necessarily locked into 1950s gender stereotypes.
Yeah, it's took a long time.
Took a long time.
But it feels like it's going in the right direction.
It took a long time in the sense that a human lifetime is very short, and so, it took a long time. But if you actually look at the arc of history, the human species in its current form has only been around for 6,000 years.
Yes.
And for about 5,500, 600 of those years, it's been, there's one way of doing things all the time, every time.
Yeah.
So in the sense of looking at social progress, again, it moves very slowly from our perspective. But if you looked at it from a macro perspective, there's a definite kind of juncture point where it's speeding up very quickly.
Yes, yes. If we were 100 years in the future looking back, you go, wow, what a progressive time.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Or, if you were back in time, and looking at how we are now, it's huge leaps and bounds. That's not to diminish the fact that there's still huge leaps and bounds to be made.
No, of course not. Of course.
But I think that idea is very much lost in the discourse of, focusing solely on what still needs to change without celebrating what has changed.
Yeah. One of the scenes I find fascinating is right at the end at the debutante party when a drunk man declares, "Goodbye, cruel world, you don't understand me, I'm just a teenager, I got problems," and then deliberately falls backwards into the pool. And it's at that point the young boys, I feel like that's the point where the young boys grow up, because they're really disgusted by his actions, and you can see that they feel a resentment that these girls are, punchlines or statistics for news stories.
Yeah.
And, I feel like that's the message of the movie, that women aren't a mystery to be unraveled. They're people.
They're human beings.
Did you love that that's a really beautiful and sincere moment with those boys, but then it still finishes on that scene of them standing out the front holding up a lighter.
Oh, yeah. That won't light properly.
And it was such a beautiful, the sincerity of it, and you've seen them grow up, and then, it felt like a stroke of genius that it took, four attempts for
I was, as it was happening, I was like, is this a mistake that they've just a perfect, kismet
bit of...
But it's, they've got that idea of that they've grown up.
Yeah.
But, they haven't.
Yeah.
It's not like, maybe in an ancient tribal society where there was a 3-day ritual where you got a tooth knocked out of your head and you had to wander the desert and you came back a man. Sure, that's a fucking line in the sand.
Yeah.
Our society, there are these milestones, but, I didn't emerge from the year 12 formal a man.
Yeah. Thank goodness.
My tribal ritual was getting drunk and singing Love Shack at the year 12 formal. It doesn't, the idea that they have, that they've grown past all that, is just an idea. So it's actually very appropriate that they, after the debutante ball, the theme of which is asphyxiation, and they're all wearing Diamante gas masks.
Yeah.
Fantastic. But it's totally appropriate that they go back and do a very teenage-y thing.
Yeah. Only a few more questions. Why do you think the girls invited the boys over to their house on the night they were going to kill themselves?
That's something I can't get my head around, because it seems quite a spiteful act.
So I'm a little bit uncertain of how I feel about it. And for everyone listening, if they have theories on it, would love to hear it. Go to the Facebook page and please share it with us. But the I wondered if it was a little bit like, because it was all that kind of in the lead up to that, it was the listening to music and talking through songs and the cards and everything. And it's funny because you see that little moment where one of the boys fantasizes that they're all going to be in a car driving along.
Yeah, it's a beautiful moment.
And it's, but then it's almost like that last moment is the girl saying, it's almost like Patricia Arquette in Lost Highway saying, you will never have me, you know? And it's almost, this is almost like you never knew us.
Yeah, I think it is that, and you know, again, I've only seen the movie once, so I'd have to rewatch it to get my head around that. But it seemed jarring in the sense that I would understand, like, I guess the way I read it is, you know, you have this idealized idea of who we are,
yeah,
and we're here to show you that it's not what you think,
yeah.
But their interactions prior to that moment are quite sweet,
yeah.
You know, playing the records over the phone, and even the little stickers that the girls put on the letters that they send to them, the rainbow and the unicorn and that kind of stuff. There's an innocence to it that both the boys and the girls are participating in. And so it was, I mean, I made an audible noise in that moment where they walk down into the basement and he's dancing and then bumps into the legs hanging from the rafters. And it was, I don't have a fully formed idea on that yet.
No, neither do I. But that was kind of where that's my initial thoughts anyway until I get to watch it again.
And,
but it might be something that I might have to, like I have been thinking about it a lot. To be honest, I've rewritten that question a few times since I've watched it as I, you know, kind of, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's this. Mm. It's funny because we're approaching this set of, following her movies in such a different way to what we did with Nolan, it means that it's quite fresh. Like there's a question that I deleted. I'll tell you at the end. There's a question that I deleted that I thought about, and then I went, no, this is going to take us in the completely wrong direction. Mm-hmm. So I'll tell you that at the end. But that's been kind of fun with the process of, where are we coming at this, rather than movies that you've seen, you know, 25 times in a row. But I found that scene, you know, the exchange of music, it was a part of that. That's a part of my teenage life that I do miss, where it's like that pureness of enjoyment that is untainted by anything other than this is how I'm feeling.
Yeah.
I found that quite beautiful.
Yeah.
In the end, this is not only a view into young women and the way they're viewed by the people around them, but also an elegy for how life passes through us and changes us. In the end, life is essentially unknowable, and even the memories that fuel the people we are today are fuzzy. In the end, is there any way to be true to yourself when you're made of such unreliable information?
I think you can only be true to the version of yourself that you currently are.
Yeah, right?
That's it.
That's how I felt as well.
Yeah.
Two more questions. Do you think the boys, once they're grown men, learn the right lessons from the sisters?
I wonder that because, I mean, These sisters have basically become mythological creatures.
Yeah.
You know, in their memory. So I wonder, can you learn the true lesson of something when something's so idealized?
Yeah.
You know, they have all this mystery and romanticism to this event, but really it's, you know, five young ladies killed themselves and it's fucking horrible.
Yeah.
It's fucking horrible.
Yeah.
You know, and did it in such a, going back to that thing of, you know, how they're all dressed the same in quite a cultish way. The fact that they all did it at the same time, you know, and it did seem to be somewhat of a fuck you to the parents. The story's horrible.
Yeah.
So probably not.
Yeah. Well, but when I say the lessons that they learn, not that they should, like, I just, because they were still alive, that's why I asked the question. Not that the girls were maybe even sending out lessons, but it's
I don't know. I like,
Like, the narration's fascinating because it does feel quite insightful in many ways.
There's insight to it, but there's that, you know, and, you know, like, I kind of blanch against the nostalgia and the looking at the past through, you know, soft focus filters and that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, sure, there's some lessons learned, but that kind of romanticism that's connected to it, I don't particularly resonate with that. Like, I don't look at the past to me is the past. It's not this idealized time. There's idealized moments of all through my life.
Yes.
I don't look back on my, you know, and maybe that's a testament to, you know, my life has been kind of, there's been great moments all through. I guess if you kind of gotten to a point where, you know, if you're Trip Fontaine and life has become very, you know, locked in, you do look back on the past as like, oh man, it was so much better back then.
Yeah.
Sorry, I went off track.
No.
Another favorite moment for the listener.
Yeah, have a drink. Final question, which ties in perfectly with what you're saying. On a scale of 1 to 10, how wrapped are you that you're not a teenager anymore?
Oh, fuck, man. You cannot pay me $1 million to be a teenager again.
Right. So true. By the way, the question I was going to ask you, and I didn't know how I wrote it down. I didn't know how I felt about it.
Yeah.
I was a bit confused, and then I saw my manager for the first time in 14 months in person, and she's seen this movie and read the book, and I asked her the question. I said, I don't know how I feel about this, and she told me, we discussed it, and I took it out because I thought it would take us in the wrong direction. But for a moment I wondered if there'd been any molestation through with James Wood's character, and the reason I thought that was because there was the point where he comes into the room and he sees Cecilia, and then not long afterwards the young boy looks up in the tree and sees Cecilia, and I didn't know if there was a connection there, but I actually thought that takes it away from what's actually going on in the movie. And it was a brief moment.
Yeah.
But I ultimately thought it was incorrect. And
I didn't read that at all.
And Helen said to me she didn't see that either. And it was like, and it's more powerful if it's not.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think he's just, to me, I just read that guy's goofball dad.
Yeah.
Goofball dad surrounded by, you know, surrounded by girls and women.
Yeah.
You know, and just kind of whatever, going through his life.
Like the beiges of dads.
Yeah, but he also seemed to be kind of, you know, obviously he's more liberal than the wife.
Yeah.
In that he's kind of encouraging them to live a little bit.
Yeah.
And I saw that as kind of an act of kindness.
Yeah. Yeah.
And acceptance of just the reality of life.
A nice, weak, meek.
Yeah, meek dad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some squid bits for you. Coppola wrote the script for the film in 1998, but the movie had already been greenlit by another studio. The production company was dissatisfied with this version of the script, though, so when the rights to the novel lapsed, Coppola pitched her manuscript. She loved the novel the movie is based on, and said that she didn't know she wanted to be a director until she'd read The Virgin Suicides and saw how clearly it had to be done. Kathleen Turner was the first actor to sign on to the project and had known Coppola since they co-starred in Peggy Sue Got Married.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. James Wood signed on after receiving the script from Francis Ford Coppola and was impressed by the script and the dark humour.
Uh-huh.
A few actors auditioned for Lux, but Coppola went... By the way, I've just noticed I'm saying Coppola and Coppola, and I don't know if that's really annoying for anyone. I should agree on... I'll settle on one. Sophia went on her gut to hire Kirsten Dunst. Dunst was nervous in the beginning because it was her first sexy role and wasn't certain how it would play out because there's so little dialogue. And
right.
It's like, yeah, of course, imagine. I already thought she was great, and I've always thought she's a great actor.
Yeah, she's great.
But I hadn't really thought about that, and I thought, oh, yeah, you young kid, and there's amount, not the normal type of dialogue that you'd expect, so...
And she eventually becomes Sofia Coppola's muse.
Yeah, fascinating. The author of the original novel, Jeffrey Eugenides, visited the set and supported the movie, but said he viewed the girls as more of an entity than actual people, and this is fascinating. He suggested... What he would have done is hired different actresses to play the same character, and the actresses would have changed depending on who they are speaking to, which is a logistical nightmare, but what a fascinating idea.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I would love to see someone else do something 100%. With that. That to me was one of the all-time great suggestions for something. And I don't know if it has been done, but I thought, what a great idea.
Yeah.
Paramount Classics didn't give the movie a wide release because they were afraid girls might commit suicide if they saw the film. The movie was made for $9 million and grossed just under $5 million. Coppola said that one of the inspirations for making the movie was the dearth of coming-of-age films from the female perspective.
Yep.
Aside from John Hughes' movies, Coppola found most teen films in the 90s to be lowbrow and not well-crafted.
Yep.
Sofia Coppola received the book from Sonic Youth's Thurston Moore. Alicia Silverstone was offered the role of Mary Libson, but turned it down. Coppola also offered a role to Scarlett Johansson, but she considered the script to be too intense. And then, of course, they make Lost in Translation the very next film. Coppola played Kathleen Turner's little sister in Peggy Sue Got Married, which was also directed by her father, Francis. Teresa's date, Jake Connolly, I didn't recognize him, was Hayden Christensen.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I didn't recognize him. I saw the name. I was like, oh, fuck, Anakin. The girls' deaths are foreshadowed in the prom photo with Lux's hand reacting to the water dripping like she's holding a cigarette and she's found dead with her hand hanging out of the car holding a cigarette. Bonnie's arm is scratching her up her back but appears to resemble a hanging, which is how she died. Teresa's eyes are closed and she took her life with sleeping pills. And Mary is stuck between her sisters and she gassed herself to death in the oven.
Yeah.
Just before Lux heads to the car in the garage, you can see a little tear under her eye, which foreshadows their deaths as she is the last one alive. And the Virgin Mary cards mix sexual and religious metaphors throughout the movie. We see Virgin as a sexual element, but also Virgin Mary as a belief system that Mrs. Lisbon believes in wholeheartedly. Later, we see a bra hanging from a crucifix in their bedroom, a statement on the girls attempting to understand their sexual awakening in relationship to their mother's insistence on purity.
Very good, very good.
I was already happy with our decision to watch these movies. 100%. And I, as I said, top three decisions after a comedy gig to go home and not hang out with comedians and watch this film. Is there anything that you want to add? Any other thoughts?
No, I'm very glad that this is where we're going now. Very good. Because it was very easy to talk about the Nolan stuff.
Yeah.
You know, there were three podcasts, I think, where I didn't even need to rewatch the film before we recorded.
Yes.
They're kind of in there. But, and I was a little bit nervous about talking about a film I've only seen once.
Yeah.
But I'm very much looking forward to the rest.
Well, I felt a bit of pressure putting these questions together as well because, you want it to be interesting for everyone that's listening. I want it to be interesting for you to create conversation.
Yeah.
And then also, I'm extremely cognizant of the fact that we are two white men watching these films. But this is why we're doing it because there's heaps of podcasts out there with heaps of dudes with dicks talking about dudes movies with other dude dick movies, you know? And so I really felt like I was trying to shift myself so I'm looking at it correctly and thinking about it differently.
Yep.
And, I'm wrapped.
Definitely.
I'm in a really good mood. And the next one's Lost in Translation, which you said you've seen and you can't remember.
20 years ago.
I rewatched that last year, purely by chance, and I can't wait to rewatch it because I think we've got a lot to talk about. Anyway, I'm going to let you go. That was Virgin Suicides, and Ben will be back.
Thank you.
Thank you to Ben Elwood for helping me kick off our Sofia Coppola viewings. I can't wait to watch the rest of her movies, and I'm loving the different stories we'll be inspired to talk about over the next couple of months. You know, I hope we're up to it. She's a really smart movie maker, and, Ben and I are going to have to step up, I reckon, so we're both excited, and I hope you're excited about this as well, especially if you haven't watched her movies too. We're all in this together. Don't forget to check out Something is Killing the Children. And also, if you're watching WandaVision, please come over to our Facebook page, join our little private chat, and let us know what you think. This season is all about broadening our listenership, so if you'd like to recommend us to any friends or colleagues, or even leave us a top review online, that would, as always, be appreciated. I'll be back later with the first episode of my rewatch of The Leftovers, so if you haven't started yet but want to get in early, you have a couple of days to do that. Otherwise, you might like to wait and have a listen to the episode, which I'm hoping will be out by the end of the week. That is the aim, anyway. Since we discussed the virgin suicides and the way people can view you from afar, I thought I'd leave you with this quote from Susan Sontag and the relationship people have with photography. Sontag said, "To photograph people is to violate them, by seeing them as they never see themselves, by having knowledge of them they can never have. It turns people into objects that can be symbolically possessed." That's a quote to keep you thinking for a while, right? Until then.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's Amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.